Journey Church is a community and movement, a fellowship of discovery. We desire to love well and serve often, while together we explore the adventurous love story of Jesus.
So, Father, a declaration to begin our morning, to speak to truth, a truth that is self-evident. You deserve the honor and the glory. Not just for what's happened historically, not just for what you have done in our understanding of time, but beyond. And so, Father, it's our great desire that you would hear the hearts of worshiping children as we say thank you. So for many, today is that Sabbath pause. It's that day of resting and reflecting. And God, in that contemplation and reflection, what you hear from our hearts, in the early parts of the day, we recognize that it's you that deserves the glory. And when we reflect on you, we are filled with gratitude. So we give you worship. Thank you for the invitation to sit at your feet and come to the table. We're here, we're listeners. In Jesus' name, amen. Would you be seated? So Jesus was going for a walk. He did that a lot. And as he walked, he usually traveled with, well, sometimes friends, sometimes followers. Often there were people curious. As time went by and news of his ministry spread, sometimes there were just throngs of people. And so Jesus was, there was a lot of giving. There was a lot of pouring out of himself. There was a lot of emptying of himself. And we kind of pick up a story where this is happening. Jesus is he's loving people. He's sharing truth. Just recently in this chapter, we're going to be speaking from Luke chapter 10, he was debating these guys named the Pharisees. They were really obsessed with keeping rules. They dealt with a lot of insecurity. They were very religious men, in all the bad sense of that word, religious. That it was about rules and formula, had nothing to do with truly honoring God. And at the end of this long walk, they came upon a city, and the city's called Bethany. And to give you kind of a frame of reference, for those of you who have any kind of a, if you picture Jerusalem in your mind, if you've seen a map of Israel, or maybe even in recent days with all the stuff going on, I don't know if they've showed you kind of a map of where things lay in Israel. But he comes upon this city in Bethany. Bethany's just 2 miles outside of Jerusalem. It's at the bottom of a mountain, and you go up and over the mountain, and actually you can travel through, literally through the Garden of Gethsemane, down into the Kidron Valley, and back up into Jerusalem. So it's pretty close to Jerusalem. But he had friends there, good friends, that through the years, they just got to know each other. And it was two sisters and a brother. And so the three of them weren't just followers of Jesus, they'd really become friends. It was the kind of thing where Jesus came to the house and hung out, and they laughed, and they told stories, and of course they were able to learn from Jesus as a teacher as well. He was certainly a mentor in their lives, possibly even a father figure of sorts, but he was also a friend. They did what friends do. They hung out, they played spades and hearts, and they enjoyed being with one another. Well, on this occasion, Jesus is arriving in Bethany, and we'll pick up the story, Luke chapter 10, verse 38. As Jesus and his disciples were on their way, he came to a village where a woman named Martha opened her home to him. She had a sister called Mary who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. Now, if you've been in the church, this is a story you've probably heard before. And so, just like a lot of the stories in Scripture, my encouragement and my hope for you is that you would spin the diamond on the moment. Look at it from a slightly different perspective. See that there's so many truths packed in stories, and what might there be that's fresh for you today? If you haven't kind of grown up in the church, then this might be a really interesting dynamic that plays out with Jesus for you. But pay attention to a couple of key words. When our authors tell these stories, they drop in important words, and because they tell stories in such short form, certain words carry a lot of weight. Kind of the stories hinge on these words. So pay attention and see if you can catch a couple of the words. I already said one of them. Mary, who sat at the Lord's feet listening to what he said. Verse 40. But Martha was distracted by all the preparations that had to be made. She came to him and asked, Lord, don't you care that my sister has left me to do the work by myself? Tell her to help me. 41. This is in red letters. Martha, Martha, the Lord answered. You are worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. And we go right into chapter 11, and one day Jesus was praying in a certain place. That's it, boom, like there it is. But there's so much here. And I thought maybe the easiest way to kind of go through the story is to just discuss the three characters, because there are three dominant characters in the story. All three people kind of represent something in the story. Now I mentioned there's a brother. He has an interesting story because he died and then came back to life. His name is Lazarus. That happens later on. But we're going to drop in and talk about Jesus and the two ladies. So first, let's talk a little bit about Martha. If you are a firstborn, raise your hand. Firstborns? Overachievers? Great. You can put your arms down. And that's not your fault, by the way. It's because you were the firstborn. So your parents, you know, they feel like they need to raise a decent kid, and they put a lot of work into you, and they're stressed. They have no idea what they're doing. They have a child for the first time. They know they're supposed to feed it and change it on occasion. And that child's supposed to grow up to make them feel proud or something. I mean, isn't that why you have kids? You know, so a lot of us, if I'm also a firstborn, a lot of us firstborn tend to be producers, we tend to be achievers. Not all of us turn out this way. But if there are any patterns, a lot of us tend to be pleasers. We want to get it done. You know, how many of you, you're fourth born or below? Four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, you're one of those. Hands up again one more time. Yeah, you're like, Mom, Dad, do you remember me? Like, you have a kid here. What happens, like, along the way? You know, like, the pressure's not on as much as parents. They've spent a little more time doing it. They've kind of figured it out. Sometimes they even divvy it off to the older kids. Like, hey, can you take care of that one? What's his name? You know. And because it's just the nature of the family dynamic, right? So there's a pretty good chance it said Martha opened her home. I think all indications is Martha's probably the firstborn. Now, some of you have done personality tests, and I reference that every now and then. If you go all the way back to kind of Greek thought or Hebrew thought or all the way into today's modern psychology, everybody tends to organize personalities into about four different categories. There's about four different patterns to personalities. I don't know why it's this way, but most of us as humans tend to follow these patterns. Well, if you've done the DISC profile, it's one we reference a lot here, then you're familiar with the D is kind of the dominant personality, takes a lot of initiative, has no hesitation demanding. One of the things I always say about the D personality, I actually reference this in the book, is if you don't have a plan for your life, the closest D will have a purpose and a plan for your life. They're a lot like God. If you don't have a plan, they'll tell you what to do. That's the D. The C, so kind of the other end of it, the C tends to be very task-driven. The rules are very important. We follow the rules. The rules are there for a reason. Of course there's rules. We follow the rules. And why would you ever deviate from the rules? Why would we need to deviate from the rules? The C, following the instructions are very important to the C, especially if it was put in the schedule. Fine, we wouldn't change that. I mean, we agreed upon putting it in the calendar. Like, there's no deviation from that. All right, so that's the C. Now, this, by the way, interestingly enough, both of those people are people who tend to get stuff done. Like, without those personalities, we all be like Jell-O. you know, like listening to music. You know, pretty much the 60s and the 70s were the other personalities, I think, in our, like the S's and the I's rose up. And you have to have these personalities. But just like all of them kind of left to their own devices without the power of God in their lives, left to our own devices, we default to the worst version of ourselves, all right, without God. And so there's something that gets exposed in Martha, who's probably a DC. If you're the kind of person, again, just one last kind of run at this, if you're the kind of person who loves to get things done, you're not afraid to enlist others, you tend to have certain expectations about how things should work, rules are important, relaxing is not necessarily your forte, then you can probably relate to Martha. I want you to think about something for just a minute. If this is you, do you realize how much the God of the universe loves you? This story is not in there accidentally. It wasn't like, we're running low. Like, we should just throw another story in here. Like, the Trinity was having a conversation while they were breathing into Luke while he was writing. Like, I don't know. It just feels like chapter 10's a little short. Like, that's not how the stories were put in the Bible. I think it's more like the Trinity's going, we need to do something for our Marthas. Because we're going to have, you know, a few thousand years of those. And how do they know that we love them? Especially because sometimes for them it's going to be hard for them to receive love because they're so task-oriented and going so much. Well, let's offer a story that reflects what happens left to their own devices and how we actually feel about them and how we, speaking of Trinity still, how we interact with them. I think this story is put in here for you. And I think it's a picture of God's love because he knows your wiring. He knows your default programming. He actually designed you with all the best parts of those personality traits for a reason. The world needs you in a healthy place. So what happens with Martha? First of all, there's a word that jumps off the pages with Martha. Did you pick it up? She gets distracted. She just gets distracted. I love what Mark Buchanan says. He says, the devil distracts, God interrupts. And for some reason, we fall prey to the one and grow oblivious to the other. For some of us, this is really, really true. It's so easy to get distracted in what seems to be important in the moment and to ignore the interruption of God. Interruption feels like spontaneity. It feels like somehow adjusting the plan. And those of us who are wired, or maybe this isn't even just a personality thing, maybe it's just a flat-out flesh thing, that you really are obsessed with control, and you like to be in charge, and you don't like anybody else telling you what to do, you are obsessed with barking orders. Maybe it's, some of that's part of who it is. But in this moment, Martha's distracted with the task. And it's not a bad task. It's not evil. She wants to make dinner for Jesus and for the family. There's another little word that was stuck in there, though. The preparations that had to be made. There was a pressure. Had is a pressure-filled word. Had and have. I have to make this. Honey, I have to get this done. There was this pressure that Martha felt. And I think from this story, you pretty much get pretty quickly, the pressure's not coming from Mary. And it doesn't seem the pressure is coming from Jesus. And who knows where Lazarus is? He might be trying on like grave clothes, but he's not around. So where's the pressure coming from? It sounds like it's coming from Martha's own expectations of what the day could be like. Some of us do this. We're having guests over, and we have a certain way we want the house to feel and whatever else. Tell me if you've experienced this. You're having guests come over. It might even be a celebration. Like, the purpose for the evening is that you have a joyous time with family. But during the day, you've ripped your children's heads off. Are you kidding me? You left that in the corner. That sock has been there for 3 minutes. I told you to pick it up. You know, we lose our minds. So the house looks a certain way, and the guest comes over, and we're like, you're sweating still from running around the house. Oh, it's great to have you. Pick that up over there. Yeah. The whole day was set for celebration, and the kids are reeling still, and you know they're sucking their thumb in the corner, you know, trying to get over the. what happened? You got distracted from the point of what was supposed to happen because you wanted the, because the pressure, the house is supposed to look like this, meal's supposed to taste like this, it's supposed to be on this time. Somebody doesn't show up on time with the right dish and you lose your mind. It's so easy to be distracted. Listen to this statement right here. Jesus stood at the door and knocked. He wanted to have dinner with the sisters. They opened the door, but Martha became so obsessed with making dinner that she failed to enjoy the meal. That could be metaphorical for a lot of things in our life. And it's interesting, Martha's frustration, it isn't even so much with Mary. Did you pick that up? I mean, clearly she's bothered that Mary's not helping her, but the frustration actually doesn't come out aimed at Mary in this story. Martha, from her perspective, the pressure that she feels, what's supposed to happen, and the fact that things are not happening the way they're, none of this has to do with her. It's not her fault. She has no awareness or recognition in the moment that she's distracted, none. So in her mind, she already has it worked out. The fault lies with the two people in the other room laughing with each other. If we go to the scene for a minute, like, I want you to stay with the scene, because if you picture Martha in the kitchen, some of you may have actually done this. You're in the kitchen, and it's building. The frustration, it's boiling like the pot on the, it's building. They're in there, ha, ha, ha. And somebody else tells another story. And then some belly laugh in there. You start to take the spatula and hit it a little bit harder on the thing. It's all the signals, like, somebody should be in here. Finally, she just loses it. She walks out, and that's the pan on the leg, and she walks out of the room, and she lets Jesus have it. By the way, some of you have been in this scenario too, like the family disagreement. Like, have you ever been the guest over where the family starts to lose their mind, and you're sitting there? You're like, whoa, this is a little awkward. That's what happens. Right here, she's frustrated with the creator of the universe. The one who made, like, the solar system and Milky Way and planet Earth and volcanoes and, like, she's upset with him. She's ticked off. I mean, Mary, she can understand. I mean, it's time to do the dishes and Mary's off drifting with unicorns. Like, I mean, she gets Mary at some level. In this moment, it's Jesus. He should know better. And what does she do? She questions his love and concern for her. Let's call this what it is. She came to him and asked, Lord, don't you care? I wonder how many times we are spun out in the pressures of our own lives. Lord, I can't do this anymore. Don't you care? And what's Jesus' response? I think this is here for a reason, because I actually think this is consistent with how he interacts with us. And maybe you've actually had a prayer time like this, where you called out then, don't you care? And he goes, Jamie, Jamie. In my case, Jamie, 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 Jamie. What's interesting is in the brokenness and the flesh and the dysfunction of the moment for Martha, it doesn't end with her questioning the God of the universe's concern and care. It doesn't actually end there. It actually moves a whole nother step darker. She tries to manipulate it. I wonder if later on in life, like when Mary was like 65, she didn't think back and be like, what was I thinking? You know, like, that was Jesus. Because she's working. Now, most of us, when we manipulate it, it's at a subconscious level, we don't realize we're doing it. And I would suspect that's probably the truth here with Martha as well. But she's really manipulating him. Don't you care that my sister has left me to do all the work by myself? And meaning you didn't exactly get up out of the chair to help me either. Tell her to help me. Whoa, that sounds kind and invitational. Now she's directing the creator of the planet on how he should function. It's a demand of Jesus. You should tell her how she should be helping me now. It's demanding. She dictates to Jesus how he should meet her expectations. Her expectations should be met. Her demands must be met. And she's standing there, her physical posture, her emotions, her tone, her language, her words, all of it communicating this. And how often do we do this? And I'm telling you, if you really take time to follow the trail backwards, and it really has nothing to do with the moment, really. It's just to do with your own expectations, perfection, perfectionism, pressure. And there's a whole lot of shoulds in this. And I've said this before, should is a shaming word. She's basically saying, Jesus, I need you to shame Mary into joining me. Can you embarrass her? I'm attempting to embarrass everybody. Because right now, I'm so hacked off that this isn't happening, it doesn't matter. I'll create the awkward moment because I still get the win from it. How many of you guys have had a Christmas day like that one? Or a Thanksgiving day? You're like, yes, now you know why I don't visit my family. My mother's obsessed with those moments. You know, like we all tend to have a family member who's not afraid to create the awkward moment to get the achieved desire. But that's what's happening. By the way, maybe some of us should like take the story into like a holiday greeting. Go, I'd like to start the day with a little story. A little devotional before we prepare for dinner tonight. I wonder how that would affect the family dynamic. I want to give you one other word. I've used this before, but I want to give it to you because this is, I'm dropping down to like super practical here, but I want to give it to you just because I don't want to miss the moment because it's so obvious. In relational dynamics, the word is triangulation. What Martha, and I think I've talked about this before, but Martha's really saying, I can't get Mary to do what I want, so I'm going to see if I can pull somebody else into this, so I'm going to create a triangle, and maybe I can motivate them to motivate her. So I'm going to triangulate. It's not healthy interaction at all. That's, again, a form of manipulation. Sometimes, even if you, we're talking kind of the D and the C and the Martha character, but sometimes the I and the S do it. They just do it in a, they don't do it in an aggressive manner like Martha did here. They do it in a passive-aggressive manner. It's kind of couched in a kind turn with a little joke, but it's really, but there's this underlying thing in there. But that's what that's called. So if you find yourself going, I can't get the desired outcome from this person, let me pull another person in who will validate me and then try and get that person motivated, most of the time that's not healthy. And you know, kind of check in with your heart. Am I really looking for someone for counsel, or is this really gossip? And if I am looking for this for counsel from somebody about this relational interaction over here, am I asking this person to act on it so that I don't have to? You know, like, just really take some time to be aware what you're doing in the moment there. All right, so let's move to Jesus. This is Martha. What does Jesus do? Look, the very first thing, Martha, Martha. First of all, he calls her by name. Let's not miss that. He doesn't say, woman. He says, Martha. Have you ever had a moment, I'll give you an example because I think this relates. Have you ever had a moment where you're really sad about something? Like, it's really, your heart is heavy and you're on the verge of tears. And somebody comes up, they just want to be compassionate, and they put their hand on you, and then you lose your mind. And you know, you lose it. You're like, you're holding it together, and they, hey, are you okay? And they call you by name. Yeah, thank you. Like, there's something about the tenderness of a touch or your name. There is no question there is tenderness in this response. No question. You can't get past that here. He calls her by name. It's personal. He repeats her name twice. It's important. Martha, Martha. It's also important to notice he doesn't devalue her service. He doesn't say, Martha, this whole thing is ridiculous. Honestly, Nobody cares about eating anyway. I can't believe you're in that. Some of us, by the way, that's how we respond. He doesn't devalue her service, but he identifies the real problem. And he identifies the problem as, Martha, you're worried. You're full of anxiety. Do you remember the teaching that I did on don't worry about tomorrow? Let tomorrow take care of itself. Let the meal's going to be okay. Like, we actually would have been good with just like one pot. You've got 14 dishes. I appreciate the overachieving, but you're lost in anxiety. He also says this, essentially, you're creating a crisis. Some of us are really good at this, especially if you grew up in a family of origin where one extreme or the other, either there was like nothing on the radar, like your parents were like, like nothing, you know, you're like, are you alive, mom or dad? If you had that kind of parent situation, or if you had the parents that were, it was combustible, like they were always, all the time. So in one of those extremes, you may come out of that scenario and be a crisis creator. Here's why, because you might actually be more comfortable in crisis. Like that was normative for you, so when there's no crisis, you don't know how to feel. And you're not sure you have any value. So if you create a crisis, you get to solve it. I served with a guy in ministry. That was awesome. He was my boss. And everywhere he went, he created a crisis. Because he was amazing at solving them. So just kind of picture like the Lone Ranger on a white horse. But it was almost like, you know, like he paid somebody to rob the bank, then he'd come in and like solve the robbery problem. And I'm giving that picture to say, we have a tendency, a lot of us, that we want to be heroes. We want people to like us. Martha, in a way, has created a crisis so that by the time they sit down and she's waiting to eat, they're, oh, that food is some, you know what, honestly, I can't handle any more dessert. It's so good, I'm so full. Like, we can create the crisis to try and get the desired response. And if you'll take the time, some of you just really take the time and go, hey, am I a crisis creator? Do I create a crisis? And if so, why? It might be kind of important or healthy for you to even climb into that. But Jesus then offers an alternative perspective. He says, here's the deal, and this is so important for all of us, because I think this relates to every single one of us. I was very convicted by this. He basically says, Martha, and here are the words, you're worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. You're worried and upset about many things, but only one thing is needed. And he basically says, Mary's figured that out. And we'll get to that when we talk about Mary. But he says, your utilitarian way of looking at things is overblown. You know, what do you mean by that, Jamie? Our culture so greatly values what we are capable of producing. Almost everything we do is judged on the value of its usefulness. Now, not all of you are like this. Not all of you are like this, but some of you are. You're obsessed with producing. The idea of resting and relaxing is very difficult for you. If this is you, I want to talk to you for a minute. This is me. I know you. You don't want to kill two birds with one stone. You want to kill 18. Like, if you're doing this, you want to also accomplish this. I'm telling you, I can be obsessive with this. If I'm doing one action, I want to think about how it benefits me in like three or four other ways. So yesterday I went rock climbing with some friends. It was a great chance to connect with some friends. One of my sons went with me. It was a great parenting moment, opportunity for us to have relational time. It was rock climbing. It kicked my butt. So I was like, oh good, I'm going to get some cardio out of this. Like, in my mind, I'm thinking through all the layers of benefit. Oh, this is a great decision today. It didn't occur to me I could go rock climbing just for the fun of it. Like, we're just going to go. I have a bullet point list of all the benefits happening in my mind. I didn't used to be this way. Something happened in adulthood. If I bend down to pick something up, I look around to see if there's anything else I should get while I'm down there. That might be old age. No, I think I should bend down some more. It's a good core exercise. Okay, If you have any of this in you, like everything's utilitarian, like is this a useful? All your moments are measured on the usefulness of the moment. You tend to have trouble relaxing and resting. And Jesus is basically saying this in a tender way to Martha. He's exposing Martha. the worry, the anxiety, the distraction, the obsession with task, the crisis, the utilitarianism, it's Martha, it's important you understand something. I will not remove Mary's joy that's so that you can feel better about yourself. Some of us are so frustrated with happy people because they're this reflection of how we're not feeling. And if we can just make them less happy, it's a win for us. Ironically, we get a little happier. That's sick. The choices in our lives are often not between good and evil. I opened up by saying that. It's not a good and evil thing for Martha, but what is good and what is great? What is good and what is right? What is expected and what is more than is expected? By the way, if you're a young person here, I want to say something to you. I'll give you a little life coaching tip. On the job, at home, in a relationship, if you just do what is expected, that's called average. But if you can train yourself to do more than is expected, if you're asked to clean something or you're asked to serve someone or it's a specific thing on the job you're called to do, if you borrow someone's car and they go, oh, by the way, would you please make sure you put some gas in it? Sure, and then wash it for them too. I'm telling you, it's that little extra thing that on the job is how you get noticed and how you move forward. It's that little extra thing that lets people see that you care. I actually think it's very tied into the kingdom. It is an extra mile kind of concept, but I'm doing with more than what's just expected. Sometimes a lot of life is between this just good and great thing. And sometimes it's between what's good and what's right. Like this isn't evil as an action point, but in a way, I suppose you could look at it evil in a way that if it takes away from what's right, then you're missing it. And then the evil one has won because you're distracted. Let's look at Mary. What happened right? Do you notice in the story, and let me listen to what Jesus says about her again, see if you pick up the tone in this. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken away from her. When you heard the story, a good storyteller kind of helps create some visuals and sets the scene. And when you heard the story, did you get this feeling with Mary that there's almost something childlike about her? I mean, the visual of sitting at somebody's feet, doesn't that feel submissive and childlike? And can't you picture her kind of looking up at Jesus, smiling, like with her arm leaning on the ottoman, like just hanging out? There's something peaceful and serene about the interaction. For some reason, many of us have the impression that adulthood is mostly about getting things done. Like we, as I mentioned, something happens adulthood, and we just think that's the deal now. Well, I'm an adult. But what about enjoying life? And let's drop it right down to the street level real quick. Do you enjoy your life? Like, do you enjoy it? Or do you live so much of your life distracted that there's not a lot of space to enjoy? Is Sunday morning is this your own one moment to reflect and contemplate and actually feel something? Like, how good are you at Sabbath? Like, the concept of Sabbath, we've talked about this through the years. But like going, yeah. Not just reflecting and going, oh, I have so much to be thankful for. It feels very head. I mean, in your heart, you're like, man, like life is just so good. The moment you drive and you're like, the color green, yes, love that. So, oxygen, I love oxygen. Like I think people that really enjoy life, they say goofy stuff like that. They kind of laugh a lot. And sometimes it's not funny. And they don't care. Not just life. Do you enjoy God? Do you enjoy sitting at his feet? Do you sit at his feet? whose expectations are we really keeping? Where's the great rule book in the sky that says you're supposed to work this specific amount of hours and accomplish these specific goals? And, you know, some of us, we're continuing to live on the programming that was given to us as a child in our family of origin, or maybe a denomination, or a certain part of the country. I had a friend of mine, he grew up in Michigan, and he grew up in a blue-collar family. And he said, you know, when my kids are teenagers, they're getting up at 5 a.m. I got up at 5 a.m. I worked a summer job. I work at 5 a.m. I worked 60 hours a week, and that's what my dad did, and I understand a good work ethic. And I remember him telling me this. And one day we interacted with each other. We were talking about something. His kids are teenagers now. He goes, yeah, you know what? I want my kids to have a good work ethic, but I realized, like, they don't have to do it the way I did it. And they can enjoy life in different ways. And maybe you work smarter and not harder. And I have this thing about how many hours, and maybe it's not that. A brief caution for those of you who go, I knew I shouldn't get a job. Honey, listen. I know I'm going to have a hit song sometime in the next 10 years. This is not for you. Ignore the message. Mary. She's not bound to societal rules. She chooses to learn from Jesus. It was unusual for a woman to sit at the foot of a rabbi. Like, you're not supposed to do that. That you shouldn't do that. But Mary, it's beautifully kingdom. And ladies, like, this is amazing. There is a little moment here. I love this. This is such a kingdom way for a woman. Women, listen to this. Mary does not accept the degrading power over system that her place should be in the kitchen. She might choose for that, but it's not a should. It's not a shaming thing. This is what our society says. This is what our family of origin determines. And you should feel the weight of this societal pressure, this domination system that says this is the place for a woman. She doesn't accept that. Nor does she swing the pendulum all the way to the opposite direction and counter the power over system with a demanding power over move like her sister. So she doesn't swing the pendulum with a whole different level of angst and feminism that says, I'll just create another, no, I want equality, so I'm going to equal the man's dysfunctional power over system by creating a woman's power over dysfunctional system. She doesn't do that. Instead, she subverts angst, retaliation, and violence. Because what do you have a woman with a fist raised in the air? No, you have a woman sitting serenely, childlike, learning, and ignoring the social decorum of the day in peace. She subverts angst, retaliation, and violence by sitting humbly and learning from the God-man. She snubs the pseudo-masculine system of power and control and sits in a submissive yet equal manner in front of righteous masculinity. Ladies, isn't that beautiful? That's the kingdom. That's the kingdom. Jesus. What about him? Does he have feelings? Does he count? Or is he just the person in the story who's the commodity who's supposed to be giving people stuff? But what about Jesus? Like, does he get to receive anything? Like, should there be some relational exchange for him too that's beneficial? I mean, he's been busted it. He's been teaching. He's been traveling. He's exhausted. He's come back from this long walk. He came to the front door, washed off his feet. He had some water, some oil to refresh himself. He sits down, and Mary plops down with him. And he says, hey, Mary. She says, hi, Jesus. He's like, you're not going to believe Bartimaeus. That dude, I got to tell you a story. What happened? More commotion was not what Jesus needed. Food, important, yes, but it wasn't what was most important. What he needed was to sit in the presence of a friend. And Jesus, pretty good at self-care, chooses to do so. He sits and rests and enjoys the presence of a friend. He chose relationship, and so did Mary. Mary and Jesus show us what it means to stop, to sit, to rest, and in doing so, they love well. Few things are needed in life, Jesus says. Indeed, there's one that's most central: eternal companionship. And so let me ask you this, what does companionship mean to you? What if you reframed the way you looked at your relationship with Jesus, and instead of feeling the utilitarian need to spend time with Jesus, I should spend more time with Jesus. Have you even said that to a friend? Oh man, I really should spend more time reading the Bible. I really should spend more time in prayer. What's the motivation? I feel shame. What if you completely reframed your interaction with Jesus, and rather the utilitarian need to spend time with him so that your life would be better, or so that you could be stronger against temptation, or so that you would feel emotionally close, or so that you could downplay that voice of shame? What if you actually considered Jesus for the person that he is and loved him? Not for what you get out of it, but for what you can give. Like, oh, yeah, I want to spend time with Jesus because I want him to feel my love for him. Like, I think he would really enjoy that. He's good at enjoying. And it's a desire for him. Like, he wants it. He longs for it. He's asked me, invited me. I want to fulfill that desire for him. How might that change the way we interact with God? I close with this. I leave it to you to make some parallels. From The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Aslan is crucified on the great stone table by the White Witch. He comes back to life. There is a resurrection. And Susan and Lucy are there. Oh, children, said the lion, I feel my strength coming back to me. Oh, children, catch me if you can. He stood for a second, his eyes very bright, his limbs quivering, lashing himself with his tail. And then he made a leap high over their heads and landed on the other side of the table, laughing. Though she didn't know why, Lucy scrambled over to reach him, and Aslan leaped again, and the mad chase began. Round and round the hilltop he led them, now hopelessly out of their reach, now letting them almost catch his tail, now diving between them, now tossing them in the air with his huge and beautifully velveted paws and catching them again, and now stopping unexpectedly so that all three of them rolled over together in a happy, laughing heap of fur and arms and legs. It was such a romp as no one has ever had except in the kingdom of Narnia. And whether it was more like playing with a thunderstorm or playing with a kitten, Lucy could never make up her mind. And the funny thing was that when all three finally lay together, panting in the sun, the girls no longer felt in the least tired, hungry, or thirsty. Psalm 118:24, this is the day that the Lord has made. Today, he made today. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Would you bow your heads and close your eyes with me? A place of reflection. Maybe stare at the floor. If you're writing in your journal, please continue. When's the last time you forgot about being hungry, tired, thirsty? just sat at Jesus' feet and smiled. That was it, because that was enough. Maybe you had a morning like that. I did. I can't explain it. I don't really fully know why. I guess I know I've been thinking a lot about his word in this passage in particular, and maybe by his grace it just settled into my heart. I got up this morning and just sat on my front porch with Jesus and smiled. I wish I could say every morning was like that. But today, I'm enjoying him. How about you? Do you know him as an abstract theological doctrinal position, or do you know him as an eternal companion, person, friend? Whatever's going on in your heart, would you tell him about it? Lord, God, Father, friend, Jesus. Thank you that you interact with us in so many different ways. Thank you for being tender and playful with us. Would you remind us that our lives are not meant to be just about getting things done? Would we just be? Just rest. Would you speak to each of us this morning, Lord, in a conversational way? Find us as your children, listening and worshiping. In Jesus' name, amen.